in you because of your grace and goodness that you've shown us in the Lord Jesus Christ. And it's in His name that we pray. Amen. We're continuing for just a little bit in this session on topic number 14, Christianity in Asia, which we began the previous time. And last time we focused that the main point, really, in looking at this is to drive home the fact that Christianity in Asia has a long history, a varied history, a rich history. We noted at the beginning, and we used Sam Moffat's volume 1 of his History of Christianity in Asia. Here's a copy of the second edition, 1998. We noted along with him that when you look at the imperial world in Asia as of 2,000 years ago, you really had four first century empires: the Greco-Roman Empire, the Iranian or Persian Empire, the Chinese, and then the Indian. Those of us who were raised and educated in this particular part of the world will have had the focus of much of our education, whether it be in literature or in history or in ways of thinking, in languages, we will have had a strong emphasis, if not almost an exclusive emphasis, on the heritage of the Greco-Roman Empire. And that means that we would be deficient, most of us, in our familiarities with and instincts of affiliation with these other world empires present in Asia 2,000 years ago. But we need to dislodge ourselves a little bit from that confinement to be able to more fully identify with the Christian church around the world, including the Christian church in Asia. So we have to think about what's happening in the Iranian and Persian empires, the Chinese empire, and Indian empire. We looked at the reality of an early first century presence and then a continuing presence of Christianity in India. Briefly, we considered the development of the Asian church in general and how there was a break between East and West with Nestorius and that controversy. And then Moffat's next section is from Alepin to the Crusades. Alepin was not the very first Christian to reach China, but he is the first documented missionary to reach China. There's a Nestorian monument that has been discovered and examined, and that monument is dated 635 AD, or CE, to use the academic neutral nomenclature. That's the early 7th century. Now, we normally don't think of Christianity having a presence in China that early. We probably realize that Jesuits in the modern times, and then certainly in the 19th century, Christianity coming in to Asia, but Syrian, Persian missionaries reached China, and Christianity flourished in many ways in the 7th century onward. And the fortunes went up and down in China over the ensuing centuries. Now, one impending struggle that Christianity in China and in general parts of Asia encountered was the spread of Islam. You'll see these few maps that are difficult to make out, but this is the early growth of Islam from the 630s, kind of simultaneous basically with Alepin and others reaching China. Islam begins with Muhammad and then spreads across North Africa and starts spreading into Asia, and this takes us up through about 750. When you go over the next several centuries, you'll see that Islam is spreading downward into Africa and down the East Coast into various parts of Asia, including throughout the old Persian Empire and spreading into China and downward into India. And then when you take it from 1400 onward up to 1900, a further spread of Islam and consolidation of its presence in Africa and throughout various parts of Asia. And that will prove to make the political standing of the Christian faith oftentimes tenuous, to say the least. And so the Christian faith in pockets of Asia, including in China, is going to be affected greatly by the way that Islam grows. we noted earlier that the growth of Islam into Europe, both into Iberia and then into Eastern Europe, also has an effect on Christianity in Europe over the centuries. Again, these are just very general maps encompassing centuries of growth and development. Moffat's next section then is from Genghis Khan to Tamerlane. And he notes that with Genghis Khan in the 1200s, you have the spread of the Mongol Empire coming down through China into Asia, stretching over into Eastern Europe, and a worldwide empire in many respects. And that will create over the next two or three centuries a Pax Mongolica, he calls it, similar to what you saw in the Pax Romana in the early centuries of the Christian faith around the Mediterranean world. And so here there's a relative period of peace. Different rulers in different areas throughout Asia become Christian, a few of them, or at least sympathetic to Christian. But with, and during this period, Franciscan missionaries will re-enter China. They enter for the first time, but that means a re-entrance of Christianity into China in the 1100s and the 1200s, and you can see another growth in parts of China of Christianity with the Franciscans. But then with Tamerlane, who is a fervent Islamic Mongolian leader, he seeks to do away with any other religious faiths throughout much of Asia where he was in control, and that again spells a further eclipse of Christianity from much of Asia, to where when you get to about 1500, Christianity in Asia basically looks the way it looked at its beginnings. A pocket in Syria, a few pockets in India, and hardly much of anything in between. And in your readings in Moffat, you read about some of his speculations, or that's not the best word, explorations and discussions as to why that occurred. A tenuous political position, theological controversies. One main reason he cites is never fully being at home in certain areas. It remains Syrian, for example, and therefore somewhat foreign in many places. And so you have Christianity, which with a long 1400-1500 year history in many parts of Asia, some parts of Asia, going back to where it was almost in the very beginning. Then you have the modern missions movement. Now, I'll talk a little bit later about how I like to see the modern missions movement stretching over the past 500 years. In the literature, it's usually described as encompassing the last 200 years, basically with William Carey in 1792. I think there are advantages in seeing it as a continuous movement basically over the past 500 years. If for no other reason, it's coming out of Europe and then later North America. But you can see with these arrows pointing for the overall spread of Christianity over the centuries, we looked earlier at this map and saw some early development, but you see coming out of Europe, Christianity, of course, under Portuguese control coming around Africa and into parts of Asia. Then you have under Spanish control coming to the Americas and then spreading across America to the Philippines, and it's really in places like Japan where Spanish missionaries and traders and Portuguese, or at least those under Portuguese protection, missionaries and traders meet. And then soon you have English and Dutch traders going around the world. And then later on, once you reach the 19th century, in the 18th century, you'll have Moravian missionaries and other pietists going, Lutheran missionaries coming to India, for example. And then in the 19th century, it's when the British and Germans and French Catholics and then North Americans start to go to all other parts of the world. And so that's a very clear movement of the modern missions movement, including a reentrance of the Christian faith into parts of Asia. And again, in phase one, if you will, into Asia, you have Portugal leading the way and Spain in a limited way when you think about the Philippines. And then with phase two in the 19th century, France. I didn't mention, by looking at this map, the strong, important role in Asia that Russia plays in its spread eastward. And Russian missionaries seeing tremendous success in Eastern Asia, in Japan, and in what we now call Alaska. Those are like the trophies of Russian missionary expansion in the 19th century. And then various Protestants, Scandinavian missionaries, along with others that we just mentioned. And much of what we see in Asia, various parts of Asia today in terms of Christianity, are direct offsprings of that modern missions movement. In the elective course later on in the term after this class is finished, we'll do some further readings in Ramakandra, including some sections that he entitles A Gospel for the Whole World and Gospel Praxis. Just a couple of notes before we move on to the next general topic. I think many Asian Christian writers have pointed out that while modern Christianity has come into Asia from the West, and therefore there's this ongoing wrestling throughout most all parts of Asia at making it indigenous, making it feel at home, in the attempt to make it feel at home, they'll go back 2,000 years and then earlier than that and see that, wait a minute, the Christian faith has Asian roots already. And the Christian faith, it truly is for the whole world. It's not a Western religion. Now, oftentimes they are saying that to compatriots within their own settings who will argue against Christianity because it's a foreign and namely a Western religion. And so Christians oftentimes in their own settings have to say, wait a minute, no, it's not. There are Asian roots and it's made for all sorts of people. That's who God is. And then in his discussions on gospel practice, Ramakandra points towards how in many parts of Asia, the Christian church is in a position today of a socio-political minority. Many Christian communities are in situations of deep poverty. I mean, you think about the Philippines, for example. You can go almost anywhere. And it's through communities of Christian people living out the Christian faith and justice and mercy and longing for peace to where the way it goes forward for most communities there. There's not a position of affluence in most cases and not a position of great socio-political position. Korea would be one possible exception to where you have about a third of the population being Christian. You have numbers of influential political business leaders being Christian, and you have had, despite bumps in the economic road over the past several years, you have the economic strength to be able to send out Korean missionaries, coupled with the zeal of the church in Korea to send missionaries out all over the world. Should we include the Portuguese and Spanish spread of the Christian faith as spread of the Christian faith because their colonizations involved oppression of indigenous peoples, and did they really bring Christianity? Well, to speak briefly to that, because we'll talk a little bit more about it later, the Portuguese did not colonize. There was a difference between what the Portuguese did and what the Spanish did. You can look at Brazil as different than what the Portuguese did from what they did in Africa and in Asia. But the Portuguese didn't have the resources to colonize. They didn't have the will to colonize. And the peoples whom they met, both in Africa and Asia, were not able to be colonized. And so they were only able to establish small trading posts along the coast, generally speaking. The Spanish obviously did bring a certain ferocity to their conquering of peoples in the Americas and in what come to be known as the Philippines. And there was a great deal of oppression of indigenous peoples. Certainly many under the influence of Portuguese and Spanish political rule and missionaries were baptized into the Roman Church. And stepping back and looking at the wider Christian picture, at least in terms of a religious studies classification, people entered into the Christian church. How much was genuine Christian faith? I definitely believe that in many, many cases, there was for sure genuine Christian faith that was developed and birthed and grown for a number of reasons. How, as Protestants, we evaluate all that, it again can get tricky. But then when you couple that with looking at what happens in the 19th century and the definite colonization that occurs in Africa and Asia primarily by Protestant countries, you have to ask yourself the question that many people have asked. Well, with that colonization, how much of that was Christian expansion, civilization expansion, political economic expansion. And undoubtedly there's an entanglement there as well. Yes. What about the comment that many churches in Asia are in danger of syncretizing the Christian faith? Syncretism is always a possible reality wherever the Christian faith exists. Undoubtedly in parts of Asia, as in other parts of the world, syncretism occurs. I would call us back to that particularization versus universalization of the Christian faith, that tension that always is going to be present. If the universal characters of the Christian faith lose their force to combat the particularization of the Christian faith, you're going to see a syncretism occurring. That it would occur more in Asia than in other parts of the world, I doubt. I see no less of a particularization / syncretism in terms of tendency of the Christian faith in this part of the world than I have seen in Asia. In Africa, you see a similar sort of mixing, and again, how we understand that, what actually is happening, becomes an important question. And again, not to dispel with the reality of syncretism and not to do away with the need to critique syncretism, but as someone said, no one ever calls himself a syncretist. Okay, let's go to topic 15, Africa. First question, why would we look at Africa? Take you back to a couple of charts that we saw earlier. When you look at the growth of the Christian church worldwide and where Christians now are throughout the world, if you look at the light blue bar representing African Christians making up their percentage of the worldwide Christian church, it's a sizable percentage of the worldwide Christian church. And many people have said, statistically speaking, especially if you talk about sub-Saharan Africa, you know, there's a big difference between North Africa and sub-Saharan Africa. And then within sub-Saharan Africa, there's differences, of course, generally speaking, between West Africa, East Africa, and Southern Africa. But if you talk about sub-Saharan Africa, you're talking about perhaps the most Christian area, statistically speaking, in the world. I'll remind you of a couple of particular countries, but in Africa, you could look at a number of other ones here, Kenya, Nigeria, and the Christian affiliation of the population is phenomenal. Nigeria having close to half of the population being Christian, would that be an accurate assessment? More than half, our Nigerian friend says, of the reality in Nigeria of the population. Just, again, I've been in various parts of sub-Saharan Africa on three different times now, and to be there on a Sunday is just, people are just streaming to go to worship services. It's just rather incredible, for example. You have a comment? Even if you're not a Christian in Nigeria, on Sunday you don't do anything. Okay. So just pointing to the widespread Christian influence of Sundays, even people who are not Christian feel that influence from the wide impact of the Christian faith. All right. Point you to this diagram of the Christian church growing serially. I think we've mentioned this here before. In a serial fashion to where the Christian faith will, in the early years, be focused in the Eastern Mediterranean and then spread throughout the Mediterranean, the Roman Empire. And again, don't let these maps with their focus on what's happening in the Western world fool you into thinking that nothing is happening Christian-wise in Asia and Africa. We've talked about Asia. We'll talk about Africa further in a minute. But you see the Christian faith, especially with the spread of Islam, moving out of North Africa or being forced out, largely, not totally, similarly in the Eastern Mediterranean, and spreading into Central and Western and Northern Europe over the centuries after the fall of the Roman Empire, and then in the past 500 years, spreading to various parts of the world, including especially in a place like sub-Saharan Africa. When you look at where Protestants have spread, the dark spaces are Protestant activity before 1910, and then Protestant advances since 1910 up to 1966. You can see extensive Protestant activity throughout Central and South America, various parts of Asia, throughout much of Central Asia, Europe, and in Central Africa. Does anyone remember something significant that happened in 1910 in terms of world missions history? I think we've mentioned it. Big conference. Where was it? Edinburgh. The Edinburgh Missionary Conference, 1910. That's just often pointed to as a watershed for any number of reasons in modern missions history. Then when you look at this other graph here, kind of looking at the makeup racially of the Christian faith, here it's called an A plus B world, and you have Caucasian Christians and then other Christians and the relative percentages making up the Christian church. You can see here when you're looking at 400 or 600, Caucasians being classified as those largely around the northern Mediterranean and the Roman Empire, but when you look in Africa and parts of Asia, more Christians would be other. But then that changes somewhat up to the mid-19th century, and then with the growth of the Christian faith in other parts of the world than Caucasian areas, especially areas like Africa, you see non-Caucasians making up the highest percentage of Christian peoples in the world. So demographically, to look at Africa as far as understanding Christianity in general only makes sense. There are many studies that currently are going on about Africa, about African Christianity, and about Africa in general. This is an electronic network that is developing, Introduction to the Dictionary of African Christian Biography. And it's seeking to record, before earlier generations leave us, the lives and events of the early part of the 20th century in Africa. You have pivotal figures and you have eyewitnesses of critical events of what is happening. And this is one work that is being coordinated by Jonathan Bunk, author you read about Money, and he is the director of the Overseas Ministry Study Center in New Haven, Connecticut. And that's the group that puts out the International Bulletin of Missionary Research. But he is heading up this particular project. He may have passed it off to others by now, but he is certainly the one who has gotten it going. All sorts of studies on just religious studies in general in Africa, and likely you're familiar with all of the varied studies in universities in the United States on African religions. African religions, oftentimes they're called ATRs, African Traditional Religions. And in the past couple of generations, some African Christian theologians have brought the issue of what to do about African traditional religions to the forefront of much of the Christian church and the need to study them academically, spiritually, what they mean for Christianity in Africa, etc. So just religious studies in general, very prominent and widespread. Just to remind us about modern political boundaries that sometimes change as things occur, but generally speaking, this represents for us the modern political boundaries, which pretty much are created in the 1880s by the European powers. Belgium in the Congo, but Belgium, Britain, France, Germany to an extent, Italy is involved, Portugal, and they carve up Africa, and you can see where certain countries are in relation to each other. And if your geography of Africa needs some catching up, go back to these maps and bone up. Early African Christianity really grows in the Horn of Africa, and an early Christian kingdom develops in Aksum, near present-day Ethiopia. But that becomes an early Christian kingdom, if you will, and the one that lingers in European consciousness. And when many Portuguese traders are going around Africa, they're oftentimes in search for Prester John and the Christian kingdom in Africa. It's important to remember, not only does African Christianity have a long history, but Africa in general has, of course, a long history. Many of the anthropological and geological studies, which as Christian people who believe in the Bible, we have to sift through the dating methods that they use, but many point to human beings actually arising in Africa. But where exactly God created Adam and Eve and put the Garden of Eden and where people developed from early on, it might be difficult for us to say. But certainly from the biblical records, the lengthy, long history of Egypt that you see recorded here, and as well long early histories in northern Africa, involving Carthage, etc. Here's the kingdom of Aksum or Ethiopia becoming Christian around 300 AD. Ghana in West Africa being an ancient kingdom and the name that the former Gold Coast chose for the name of current-day Ghana when Gold Coast became the first independent country in modern Africa. And what year was that? 1957 was when the Gold Coast became independent. The first African country to do so after World War II, after the imperial era. And that set in motion, of course, independence movements throughout. Yes. And you see, yes, the Niger region and references to Nigeria as well in West Africa. So lengthy histories, lengthy kingdoms, and it's not as though when Europeans started showing up 500 years ago, they found jungles and monkeys only, which, you know, can be the images that we have inherited, many of us. Now, this outline that I'm going to go through fairly quickly is an outline from an article by Andrew Walls in one of the journals that you might be examining in the course, Journal of African Christian Thought. And this is from its first issue, June of 98. And from your readings as well, you will note that it's important to remember that African Christianity traces its overall history back to the very beginning of the Christian faith. It's not as though Christianity in Africa begins 200 years ago, for example. It goes back to the very beginning. That's important just simply for historical accuracy, but it's important in the consciousness of many African Christians. This is a brief chart of some of the major African indigenous churches, AICs, that have arisen, that arose starting in the early 20th century, late 19th century. And you can see that the first one listed here, that started in South Africa in 1892, took on the name the Ethiopian Church. Now, one reason that they would have done that, even though they're in South Africa, is because that communicates a long-standing ancient African Christian identity. Because Christianity, with the Ethiopian eunuch in your readings in Lamine Sanet, he points out that, you know, there is the awareness that when he was an infant, Jesus was taken to Egypt in Africa. There's the strong awareness in places of Ethiopia that the direct contact between peoples in Africa and biblical Israel, going to go back to Solomon, the Queen of Sheba. So in that sense, there will be many Christian groups who will want to go back in a direct connection 3,000 years with their history. And so just naming your church the Ethiopian Church somewhere in Africa other than in Ethiopia shows that strong connection and a way of, as an indigenous church, distancing yourself from those who have come in from outside of Africa. So it's important for any number of reasons to realize that early history. Christianity does continue in Africa, in Northeast Africa, and spreading down somewhat into Africa over the centuries. But it is undeniable that with the beginnings of the comings of Roman Catholic missionaries under the protection of Portugal, you see a fresh and, in many cases, new encounter with the Christian faith amongst places in Africa. This is a chart listing where some of the early prominent Roman Catholic missionaries went in various places around the world. Here you can see an Italian missionary going to Ethiopia in the 19th century. This doesn't really mention what's happening in the 1500s, 1600s, because the main Portuguese ministers, if you will, or priests who would have gone out, would have simply been chaplains to Portuguese military posts who set up their various areas along the coast. There's no sense of needing to minister to and reach out to Africans to see them become Christian. And then even as you see the slave castles develop along the coast of West Africa, you don't see any sort of ministry to, desire to reach out to African Christians. One exception to that would have been a young African himself named Capitaine, who was somehow taken away, you know, as slave ships pulled off the coast at various points in West Africa. The different European ships would intercept each other and steal slaves or steal goods, and he was taken away from a Portuguese slave trip. It eventually ends up in the Netherlands, this young man, taken under the wing of a minister there, educated theologically, the first Africa to receive a theological, first African to receive a theological degree in Europe in the early, this is he was born in 1707, died at the young age of 30. But he returns to Africa, to the Gold Coast, present-day Ghana, and settles there near Elmina Castle, and seeks to have some outreach to Africans. Even himself wants to take an African wife, but the consistory back in the Netherlands says, you can't do that. A civilized person like yourself who's been educated can't marry a heathen woman like that. So they send him a Dutch girl so he can be properly married, and he gets married, and then at the young age of 30 he dies. But that's one exception to the rule that there's next to no ministry among Africans by Europeans. But once you enter into the 19th century and the further encroachment of European powers into Africa, you're going to see various Roman Catholic missionaries coming as Italy moves into Ethiopia, as France moves into North Africa, etc. Then, of course, intimately connected with the coming of the Europeans, the Portuguese, and the Dutch, and the British, you have the slave trade, the transatlantic slave trade that develops. Now, this is not the first slave trade in the world. It's not the first slave trade in Africa. There were slaves being taken across the Sahara Desert by Muslim traders. There were slaves going back and forth between Asia and Africa. But this one has particularly horrific proportions with estimations of, 12 million or so Africans over the course of a few centuries being taken away from Africa over to, at first, Europe and the Americas, and then more and more to the Americas to man the sugar plantations and cotton crops, etc. And that, of course, decimates many areas of Africa and has horrific economic long-term implications. And how the West today is to deal with that is, you know, a continuing topic. In the midst of that, it's interesting to note that after they reach the Americas and at other points, different African people do become Christians in the midst of horrific conditions. And the first Protestant church that has begun in Africa was actually begun by African Americans. And that story goes back to the Revolutionary War in the North American colonies, when the British promised freedom to certain African American slaves for fighting on the side of the British against the rebelling colonists. And their promised freedom, you know, once the rebellion is put down, they will have their own land and be able to have a certain measure of citizenship. Well, after the unthinkable happens and the rebellion succeeds, where are these pro-British African American freed slaves supposed to go? Because they're not really welcome in the colonies. So they go up to Canada, still British territory, and settle in Nova Scotia. Christian communities are established. The weather is not terribly agreeable to many of them, and that's another motivation to get away. But there's a missionary motivation that inspires a huge community, thousands of Christians, to go from Nova Scotia to Sierra Leone in West Africa, which has been established by the British as a relocation point for all slaves that are being freed. And this is right in the middle of the British efforts to end the slave trade as a whole. And it's those Nova Scotian African-American Christians who begin the first Protestant Christian church in sub-Saharan Africa in, I think it was 1792, which adds to the beauty of the overall story of the Christian church, and including what's happening in Africa. What you see strongly connected with the Protestant missionary movement in Africa in the late 1700s, early 1800s, is a strong alignment with the liberationist movement to do away with the slave trade. And just the horror at the slave trade, the moral fervor and crusade to have it abolished throughout all countries, and that eventually happens in the early 1800s. And then that's where you have all the different ideas of what to put in its place economically. I mean, the slave trade has been entrenched so long, if you just simply do away with it, what's going to happen to local African economies? And that's where certain ideas that Buxton and others come up with you have to bring in commerce and civilization somehow to take the place of the slave trade you're doing away with. You know, it's easy to throw rocks at some of those ideas, but you have to remember the context that people are trying to think about. What are we going to do in building up economies in local settings? When you move into the colonial phase, you have to remember that officially speaking, technically speaking, the colonial era in Africa begins relatively late. It's not until the 1880s when European powers start to assume colonial power. Most European nations weren't looking for that. They're looking to develop economies and trade, and as they compete, though, with each other, as King Leopold II of Belgium really pushes the envelope in Central Africa in his desire to acquire a monopoly on the rubber trade, that is going to force other European nations, Britain and France in particular, to push ahead with protecting their economic interests. And that's how the whole colonial phase begins, and that's where Europeans meet in Europe and just in, you know, around a mahogany table in Europe somewhere, draw out these lines that in many cases make no sense as far as where tribes are and how they're divided up and et cetera, that exist with us today. But when you think in macro historical terms, the colonial era from the 1880s until the 1950s, early 1960s is relatively short. But much missionary activity is taking place, obviously, under colonial rule. And side note here, and forgive me if I've mentioned this earlier, at least as far as British missionaries are concerned, oftentimes the stiffest opposition that British missionaries face in reaching out to new peoples comes from colonial authorities. Because British colonial authorities want to maintain order and peace. Missionaries are wanting to reach out into new territories, including, when you look at a place like Nigeria, Muslim areas. But the colonial authorities, who have to operate on a shoestring budget anyway, they're concerned about unrest developing, and they just want to maintain order and want to keep the commercial interests satisfied. And so they will pass laws and regulations preventing missionaries from going into new areas. That's just a side note in all the complex dynamics. The important place that education and schools play, and having for peoples throughout Africa being educated in basically either English or French. Some Portuguese, but generally speaking, the two main blocks are going to be Anglophone Africa and Francophone Africa, which those are still with us today. With decolonization and the church in Africa and churches in Africa face whole new issues about what to do about the modern nation states that are developing in the late 1950s, early 1960s. There's a certain cultural renaissance that goes on of kind of celebrating things African and throwing off, having thrown off the colonial yoke now to reaffirm who we are as Africans, including as African Christians. Things Fall Apart shows, you know, is a title of a well-known book that talks about the struggles that many African countries undergo with political leaders who come into control who are not ready to do so and hoard finances and military resources and basically just assume power. Pardon? This book, our friend Joshua from Nigeria will recognize, and if you don't know Chinua Achebe, he is a world-renowned Nigerian author, and this book, Things Fall Apart, was perhaps his first widely known novel. He's written others, No Longer at Ease, other novels that I would encourage you to read. I've had African friends advise me when I've asked them, what can I read to understand modern Africa and problems and issues? He's been the author that many people have pointed me to. And just to note, the breakdown of many traditional values, the encroachment of modern economies and urbanization, coupled with military havoc, the painful developments of democratic rule, and all the struggles within the world economy that African economies find themselves encountering. It's just an ongoing issue, as you know. And certainly within the Cold War, that only compounds problems, where particularly the United States and the Soviet Union just compete for loyalties, food granting, military and economic aid. And how is it that the military rulers acquire the harbor that they do? Well, it doesn't take much imagination to imagine that. Another dynamic in considering Africa in general and African Christianity in particular is that oftentimes they find themselves not just having strong Western relations, but traditional long-standing Asian relations, especially when you look at East Africa, especially when you look at problems that developed in Uganda in the 1970s when Idi Amin started throwing out all foreigners. Most of the foreigners he was throwing out were the Asians. Asians, Indians in particular, that the British had brought in beginning in the late 19th century to oversee the construction of railroads, the development of banks, because Africans couldn't do that. And the Asians, whom the British had had a while to train, and who were smarter than Africans anyway, I'm speaking tongue-in-cheek, you realize, were brought in by the Brits to rule. And so even to this day, and especially in Idi Amin's day in 1970, it was the Asians who had top economic positions in society. So he just throws them out as part of his brutal reign of terror in Uganda. And since then, they've come back in, and now people like Joseph Mutuki, whom some of you will know, who's in Kenya, who's an African Kenyan, same dynamics in Kenya, is trying to urge the African Kenyan churches to realize their missionary calling to reach out to Asians in Kenya. Up to this point, most African Kenyans with a strong Christian presence have just kind of had the posture, well, the Asians, they have their own religion. But now, no. What about that? Is part of the issue that's being pushed. And the long-standing trade routes. Islam was brought into South Africa, by the way, interesting connection here, by the Dutch, who brought Malaysian slaves to Southern Africa who were Muslims. That's how Islam makes its initial entrance into South Africa. So there are all sorts of interesting sidelights to the ongoing story of Christianity's role in Africa. Certainly along a certain border running through Central Africa, places perhaps preeminently exemplified by Nigeria. You have Christians and Muslims coexisting, oftentimes not peaceably, normally peaceably and constructively. In Ghana, where I've been probably more than anywhere else in Africa, there's a peaceful coexistence and equal contributions to schools and universities. And what sorts of lessons that can teach the rest of the world are ones that we need to consider. But the vibrancy of Christianity in Africa is certainly something to recognize. The long history of Christianity in Africa, and despite some of the images that many of us have inherited in Africa, the theological vibrancy and creativity, the huge revivals that have taken place in Africa, the diversity within African Christianity is just incredible. And to tap into that, to recognize that African Christianity in many ways is a world leader in African Christianity is just the fact of the Christian church in the world today. One more note, and then we have a little discussion before the next topic if you'd like. Much, if not most, of the cross-cultural missionary outreach in modern Africa by Christians, especially the 20th century, has been done by African Christians. White missionaries have played an essential role, and heroic efforts by European and North American missionaries. But the reality of the case was is that Europeans could not go inland. They would get sick and die, or they get killed. And there are story after story after story after story of missions who just send their missionaries and just they're going to come back in a box soon, if they come back at all. Well, who is it that has the fervor and the capability to carry out cross-cultural missionary activity? It's the African Christians. And they're the ones who forge ahead and move inland. And so much of the cross-cultural missionary activity, a current example in Ghana, again, with which I'm familiar, and our brothers from Africa tell us about many others in Ethiopia, Nigeria, and elsewhere, are you have, in Ghana, you have many people from the north, which is either traditional religion or Muslim areas, coming to the south, which is more developed, looking for work. Well, they come to the south. They're living in some shanty town areas in the capital city of Accra, and they become Christians there. Now, the Evangelical Presbyterian Church of Ghana, which is strongest in the south, has cross-cultural missionary outreach with them there, equipping them to go along the trade routes. Largely, it's a yam trade. Yams are grown up north. They're brought down south to be sold. Trucks go back up north and pick up more yams and bring them down. Well, as Christians just follow that trade route and take the gospel back here, and the EPC of Ghana is seeing one or two people come into their church or ministering up north, and they're seeking to facilitate and train, and they have to go about language learning, totally different languages. I mean, Kokomba and Ewe are totally different languages, and oftentimes they communicate with each other via English, etc. And that's just a dynamic cross-cultural missionary outreach that's going on, and that's going on all over the place. In Africa, and when you expand that, Brazil, India, etc., so much of the cross-cultural missionary enterprise today is occurring in that fashion. Any questions or comments you want to make? Yes. What impact in Africa is the AIDS epidemic having on the church in Africa, and vice versa? How is the church dealing with the AIDS epidemic? If either of you from Africa would like to speak to that, you're welcome to. My knowledge of that is pretty fragmented. I know of instances of people who are giving real attention to that from the Christian side, but my understanding is that it's having its impact in the church, perhaps not as much as the wider society because of stricter mores within among Christians, but I don't have enough specific information to answer your question really intelligently. Either of you want to speak to that? Yes, speaking from Ethiopia, just at the beginning stages, but the church has maybe seeing the AIDS epidemic as something that shouldn't be touched. It's bad and distant, often known how to reach out to society, but NGOs and government organizations realize that because of stricter sexual morals, to work through the church and with the church is the way that they should go. And so as a long-term solution, the church is beginning to awaken to its responsibility. Yes. Are the Christians in Africa reaching out to different tribal groups that are found in Africa? I mean, the blanket answer to that is yes. And the example I mentioned from Ghana is an example of that. I would think, Joshua, that you could mention in Nigeria examples of cross-cultural outreach to groups that don't yet have the gospel. Wycliffe is at work in cooperation with African Christians, and African Christians joining with coming into Wycliffe as well to be about that. Or do you want to speak further to that, about outreach to new groups? I don't want to put you on the spot, but
we have a large communication or missionary work, particularly now in our church. The capital city, which is Abuja, would build a very mighty church there. It's been managed by one of our pastors. we didn't go across Nigeria from the Nigerian. So this is done everywhere. The idea of these questions, at times they don't understand which is Africa and which is not Africa. They just say Africa. And Nigeria, Africa has about 50-something tribes. So it is very difficult to understand what is Africa and what is Nigeria. But within, if you had just given us the map, per se, I wish you would just print the map and give it to us. I would have more time to point at the countries and show them where we cross, where it lies. If you can get a copy of that map, African map. Why you saw it somewhere here?
Wrong map. No. I can, I'm trying to find it. No, it was a different one. My memory is when it is. I think it's this one. This one.
See that I'm from the whole country. See, this is Nigeria. Nigeria only has about 52 ethnic groups with different languages. See, inside Nigeria, our state headquarters is somewhere here. So we move from here to this place, and we move from here to this place, we move from here to this place. The whole of this country, we evangelize, and we move from Nigeria to Niger, we move from Niger to Chad, we move from Chad to even Ghana, Guinea, Mali, all these places we go for evangelism. Only that we cannot come to where you talk about South Africa. South Africa is here. You see? So from here to here is just like from Nigeria to America. It's very far. So he just asked me and said, are you from Africa? So it sounds very odd. So it is very important for you to know. In fact, it's good that you are here to study missions, because it is very, very, very embarrassing. When I was at Calvin College, people would say, this one is from, we have cultural dances. Then they would say, okay, Indians, you are this thing, come and display. This country, come and display. Then they would say, Africa. You see, the whole of this, some of us are from Nigeria, some from Ghana, some from Kenya, some from Uganda. You just say Africa. So this thing is interesting that you are here to say this.
Thank you. That the point is well taken. Now you have to look at the tremendous diversity within such a huge area. And one more name in African Christianity that is one that you need to know. There are many others. Samuel Crowther, he grew up in this region, was taken, captured from a slave ship, was relocated in Sierra Leone, and he actually spearheaded missionary efforts. This is in the in the 19th century, from Sierra Leone into the Niger region. And he became the first African Anglican bishop in the 1800s. So Samuel Crowther is a name that in any modern history of Christian faith has to be included as a very, very prominent figure. All right, let's move next to our next topic, which is a little bit of a shift in tone to the topic of money. Now, the readings that you've done in Jonathan Bonk can't help but provoke some reaction. And from the introduction or forward to the book, there are these comments written by an African himself, remembering the diverse meaning between that general term. Similar to why when you use the term American, there's a diversity, but even more so, the diversity. The book challenges us not, this is talking about Jonathan Bonk's book, Missions and Money. This book challenges not to resignation, but through the enabling power of the Holy Spirit to struggle to remove a dangerous contradiction from Western missionary endeavors. Dr. Bonk encourages us to adopt the incarnational model of mission rejecting the easy power and prestige of affluence by an act of deliberate self-emptying. Jonathan Bach grew up in Ethiopia as the son of Mennonite missionaries, and he currently is the director of, as I mentioned earlier, of the Overseas Ministries Study Center in New Haven, Connecticut, just right down the street from Yale Divinity School. And very important study center, and they put out the very influential International Bulletin of the Missionary Research. Before we talk about this a little bit, I'll be interested in some of your reactions to this piece. Raise questions but didn't answer them. He gets to his answer later on in the book, and you'll read that section later on. But it raised questions without giving many answers. Difference between having stuff and needing stuff, or thinking that you need stuff. Attitude versus the actual reality of having things. Quickly, let's go through what he says in this chapter. He talks about the 19th, 20th century womb, he calls it, the development of lifestyles of affluence, the cultural, social, historical environment where many of us have as our backgrounds just this lifestyle. The Eurocentric belief in progress, he calls, and an unending development and increase in wealth. And then the white man's duty, it came to be called, the sense of Christian duty regarding non-Christian peoples to lift them up, and therefore the need to go and take everything that we have to offer as Westerners. Then he talks about changes in post-World War Europe and changes in the U.S. after the Vietnam War, just the war, the wars in general bring to a crashing halt in many ways. Western confidence, you have decline of the Christian faith in Europe, and in the 1960s onwards you have realizations of major changes, seismic shifts occurring in North American societies, the global realities of the Cold War and then the change of the Cold War, the global realities of a worldwide economy and the interconnectedness of the economy to where, I mean, those of you who are involved in agriculture or know people who are, I mean, people have to be aware of the rest of the worldwide economy for what it means for your bean crop, for example. Some of the most internationally aware people, most internationally aware people that I've ever met are Midwest U.S. farmers. Because it really matters what's happening in Brazil for them, for example. And then the perceptions that people have had of European life, of U.S. life, and questions that have arisen. And he notes that for many Americans who go live somewhere else for a significant block of time, come back to the United States and feel very much like strangers in their own land. And I would dare to say that for many of us who were born and raised in certain lengths of time in the United States, who've spent significant blocks of our adult lives living outside the United States and have come back fairly recently, some of our, and I don't make a generalized statement here, but just to make a point, I'll put it this way. Some of our instinctive reactions to the present crisis and how to react to it within us might be more confusing, if nothing else, than a straight line, let's go get them, sort of an attitude in the current worldwide situation in light of the terrorist attacks. Then he raises some questions about consumerism, affluence, and mission-sending church relations. He raises the question, is it really true, economically speaking, that perpetual growth is possible? He talks about life patterns that people lead. And then he makes an interesting point about the mutual self-justification that goes on, as he calls it, between North American missionaries and their supporting churches. Supporting churches want to take good care of their missionaries. You know, the old image of the missionary getting the used tea bags in the old clothes is an old joke now. And within PCA circles, and MTW circles in particular, basically, an MTW missionary is supported at the average rate of a PCA pastor. and having been an MTW missionary for how many years? Myself, 84 to 99, was that 15 years? It's a fairly good package. You're not going to get rich, but it's a fairly comfortable package with benefits, things for child's education, insurance, retirement, your salary, etc. And as one of my former colleagues pointed out to me when he left MTW to go pursue something else, he said, you don't realize what a good package it is until you try to match it with something else. But the PCA wants to take care of its missionaries. These people are important. We care for them. We want to show that we love them. Okay? But Bonk says, if there are people who ought to be able to come back to the States and be prophetic about the affluent lifestyle, it ought to be the missionaries. But how is a missionary who is supported at a fairly comfortable level going to do that? That's his lifeblood. You're just going to choke yourself if you do that. And therefore, the missionaries don't speak out against the affluent lifestyle, and there's this mutual kind of assuring each other that it's okay that goes on between supporting churches and the missionaries. So that's Bong's argument here that helps to perpetuate the problem that we encounter. Our time is up for today, but any further questions or comments? That this is not the last time we're going to visit this. We're going to look at some more things that he says and discuss them further. But any further questions or comments you want to make right now? Yes. It is a complicated situation. And, I mean, Bonk wants to say, I think by implication here, and again we're going to read him further, that it, missionaries who do go and live in less affluent situations are in a position to be prophetic about affluent lifestyles. And so I think he would say, yes, missionaries ought to speak against the affluent lifestyles that people live. A question to think about while you're reading, just think about this. You'll be doing some reading about contextualization and Christology. Think about how is it that Jesus Christ is the same Jesus Christ, and yet to a certain degree anyway, he is understood differently by different Christian people. How could that be? Okay, thank you. God bless you. See you next time.